Welcome. Can you hear me? I'm not sure whether the microphone is on or not. No? Yes, I think it is. I'll shout. My name's Kate Mallison from the Department of Law, and I'm delighted to be chairing this first session in a series that the LSE is organising on women in the 21st century. There are two other sessions which I've been asked to announce, Women in the Media on the 22nd of November and Women in the Economy on the 16th of November, so I hope people can attend that as well. But we're going to start this evening with Women in the Law. And I think it's a particularly interesting and appropriate time to be thinking about this subject. On the one hand, I think there's a great deal to celebrate when I look around and see every year the cohorts of determined and very talented young women who are coming onto the LLB course. I feel a great sense of optimism. I then go back to my office and have a look at some of the statistics about women in high ranks of the legal practice and the law generally, and I feel a little more gloomy. Two obvious and common examples. The fact that 80 years after women were first called to the bar, the proportion of barristers who are appointed QC every year, women make up about 7 or 8%, and that figure has remained stubbornly similar for the last 10 years or so. Likewise, the fact that last year was the first time that a woman, Brenda Hale, was appointed to the top court, the House of Lords. And that's at a time when, in Canada, the Supreme Court has managed to appoint 4 of its 9 members from amongst women, including their Chief Justice. So there are clearly some cause for concern, and some questions that need to be asked about why women are not trickling up in the way that it was anticipated that they would, or the speed that they would, what needs to be done about that. There are also some other questions, a range of other questions that we might want to ask, such as why does it matter whether women participate fully in law and legal practice? Do women bring something different to the law? Does it affect the legitimacy of law and legal practice that women are not participating equally? Is what we're witnessing something that's particular to the law, or is it general to all institutions of power? And these are just some of the questions. There are many others that I hope that we'll think about this evening. And I can't imagine a better qualified group of speakers than we have this evening to help us address these questions. Between them, they have an amazing range of experience at the coalface of the law, and I'm absolutely delighted that they've joined us tonight to share their knowledge and experience. And I hope that they'll forgive me if I don't give long, detailed introductions. Their combined CVs would probably take me the entire evening to go through. And they have each agreed to talk for about 10 or 15 minutes so that we've got time for questions and discussions. And so I'll start by handing over to Rosalind Higgins, judge at the International Court of Justice and former professor of law here at the LSE.
Well, thank you very much indeed, and it really does feel so good to be back here again at the LSE. I should make clear my starting point for this evening's discussion, because we do all carry, I know, different baggage of life experience with us, and it necessarily colours our perceptions on things. I have a really boring starting point. I have never, at any point in my career, experienced any discrimination. And in recent years, when perspectives have changed and employers have quite wanted to be seen as promoting gender equality, my concern rather became that the good things that were happening to me should have been because I was me and not because I was a woman. At the same time, I've never doubted those who've told me that my story is not in any way typical, and that many, many women have had and do have enormous hurdles to overcome, and that the overall pattern in my profession, by which I mean not just law, but international law, public international law, still evidences an unsatisfactory state of affairs. So there's that dual starting point. I start with something on the international law judiciary. These comments are necessarily more specialized than those you'll hear about English law generally or domestic law during the course of the evening, but it's what I most know about. And I feel you can't talk about the judiciary alone in any sensible way, any more than, for example, you can talk about the great current debate about state school entries to Oxford and Cambridge and other leading universities without also discussing the school system that leads to it. In other words, to talk about the judiciary, and Kate said a couple of words about it in her introduction, is important and it's interesting, but we won't be able to say anything sensible about that without also looking at what it is that leads to it in the long term, in career terms. But nonetheless, I'll come to some of those other things, but I will start with some talk about the judiciary and then trace some observations back along the line to what's gone before, professionally speaking. I'm the British judge on the International Court of Justice. I've now been there for 9 years. When I was elected, I was not only the only woman on the bench, but the only woman who had ever been elected. And I'm still the only woman on that court, 9 years on. That being said, I have to admit, I feel entirely comfortable and simply one of the team. I do not, during my professional work at all, I have honestly to say, notice that I'm a woman and there are 14 fellows out there. I think it enters neither my head nor theirs. Indeed, I have to admit that the only sexist remark that's been made in my 9 years there was made by me. We had a discussion about certain diplomatic privileges that are allowed to judges in terms of changing their cars and whether it should be every 2 years or every 1 year, and everyone spoke in an animated way about it, and then the president said, well, for us to take a position on this with the Dutch government, I need everyone's point of view, and Judge Higgins, you haven't spoken, you know, what do you want to say? And I'm afraid I heard the words coming out of my mouth, I want to say that only 14 men would spend 45 minutes talking about their cars. But anyway, we are simply colleagues there. Now, the International Court of Justice is the oldest of the international courts. It's been there since the beginning of the League of Nations. And the selection method for the bench there is a very special one. First of all, you have to be nominated as the national candidate by your national group, but how that national group is exactly made up varies from country to country. Those who are on it get registered at The Hague as the standing national group, but it's not made up the same way in any two countries. In some countries, the legal advisors of the Foreign Offices are in other countries they're out. In our one, they are not a member. Typically a past legal advisor of the Foreign Office will be there. a past judge of the International Court of Justice and a couple of senior law lords, or a senior law lord and a leading academic. Of course, the Foreign Office, as the shortlist gets made, do get consulted to make sure that the person that this national group has in mind isn't going to be anathema to the government. And then this national name goes forward to the United Nations, and there are competitive elections for the 15 seats. And there's simultaneous voting in the General Assembly and in the Security Council. Now, I think the United Kingdom was probably rather pleased to be nominating the first woman to the International Court of Justice, but I've never felt comfortable with that being a particular thing during the election process. I've always belonged to, if you like, the Nike approach to professional preferment, that's to say, to the Just Do It school. And so we've never made a great thing of my being a woman as opposed to an international lawyer. Now, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which is a subsidiary body of the Security Council and will in about 3 years get wound up when it's done its job as regards criminal trials concerning the Balkans. That does have several women judges. They don't have the same nomination process. They're government nominees, although they do finish up being elected at the UN. And the Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, has been a keen supporter of getting more women into all sorts of jobs, including senior political ones. And indeed, one of their early presidents of that tribunal, Jean Kirkpatrick, was a woman, and two of the three senior prosecutors have been women, including the current one, the formidable Carla Ponte. So gender is really in every way a non-issue in that tribunal. In the new International Criminal Court, which has entered into effect and is just starting up, their first case, I'm sure, will come along before too long. There, the judiciary is required to be half international lawyers and half criminal lawyers. But the election system also had a required quota for women, again with the keen support of Kofi Annan. That has led to some problems because, and now we start this feeding back into the prehistory, there really are not so many women international lawyers ready to go on a bench of that seniority. Or top criminal judges in the spread of countries that you necessarily are looking to have represented on that bench. And there is already a lot of talk about whether the quota of women, which has been achieved, whether it will or won't turn out to be at the expense of the necessary expertise. We'll have to see how that works out. Now, where do these benches come from in terms of what was their prehistory? Well, in the International Court, we're quite an interesting mixture. Some of us, and this would describe myself, are past academics who also practiced. Some are former legal advisors to foreign offices. Some are former ambassadors to the UN who were always international lawyers. That's true, for example, of my Egyptian colleague. And some were former foreign ministers who were also international lawyers. That's true of my Brazilian colleague. Now, the number of women legal advisors around the world to foreign offices is very small. The number of ambassadors to the UN is growing. There you can see year by year it's growing. The number of foreign ministers is still relatively few. The academics are still a minority. They're most certainly extremely capable women academics in international law at many of the leading universities around the world, but not so many who combine it with practice in international law. And the tradition has always been for that bench to look for the combination of a life in academia and in practice. And when I look at British colleagues, there have been a few appearances at the Yugoslav tribunal, one British woman colleague I can think of at my court, but really relatively little. And when I think of the international bar as a whole, with its, as with any bar, its great stars, I have in all honesty to say, at the moment, they're all men. And in my 9 years there, I've seen just a handful of female advocates. By the way, the stars are from all over the world, though I would say that France and Britain still have the lion's share and work, obviously, for all the countries who want to use them. Now, then you come to the question of why is this so? And others, I'm sure, during the course of the evening will have many ideas to offer as we feed back into the story of the barrister in any branch of the law before you choose to specialize in international law. When I went up to Cambridge a lifetime ago, there were three women in an intake of 100. When I, in any one year, and in my year, when I was teaching at the LSE 9 years ago, half the class doing either the undergraduate international law course which I taught or the three graduate courses, specialized courses I taught, half the women were already, half the class was already composed of women. Now then, why, if that is so, are they not going on in comparable proportions to shine at the bar? And I'm sure during the course of the evening we'll hear about remaining problems of bias, the problem of children breaks and family breaks, the need for your conferences after court at the end of the day. My impression is that solicitors have done quite a lot to try and help and become more female equality friendly over the years. I think at the bar there are great difficulties in that it's not so easy to restructure the court system, but others will talk more knowledgeably than I about this. But the thing that's never talked about when the reasons for the disparities are discussed and we look at the universities or at the professions or at the foreign offices or at the UN to say, why isn't it all better? I truly still believe that the key thing is support at home. And with a supportive husband or partner who really assists on the domestic front and who really gives moral support, is keen, considers it quite normal to fend for his own supper, then everything becomes possible. But without any one of those elements, I think everything is still very, very hard. And I think we talk about that factor all too little, and I do firmly believe that the breakthrough will never happen unless it happens bottom up from within the family as well. Now, in the last couple of questions I was asked to address, what impact do you feel you've had as a woman? Well, I do know that young women, because they come and tell me so after lectures, see me as a role model. I'm flattered. I'm glad. But beyond that, I really don't think I've had any impact as a woman. Such impact as I've had, I think, has been as simply as a lawyer, like any other international lawyer. the related question, do women bring different perspectives to the law? My clear answer to that is no. I really don't believe in masculine minds and feminine minds. I absolutely hate to be told about my female sensitivity or intuition. They are either good minds or poor minds. You're either articulate or not. You either have analytic capabilities or you don't. And as I've never worked on a bench with a woman colleague, I can't say if I'm more closely attuned to a woman colleague, but I'd be very doubtful if that were the case. When I was on the UN Human Rights Committee, it was a question of whose ideas you linked up with. Sometimes they'd be those of a woman colleague, sometimes they'd be those of a male colleague from this part of the world or that part of the world. Everything just depended on, for me anyway, on the individual concern. Finally, how important is it, we are asked, for the legitimacy of law and legal practice that the number of women working in the law, and for me, I suppose, in international law, increases? Well, because I don't believe that women bring different perspectives to the law, in that sense, it's not so important. But because all public bodies must find that correct line between an appropriate detachment on the one hand, but a non-alienation from those we serve on the other, it is important. And it's part of the wider debate on the representative quality or otherwise of the bench. And that issue, of course, goes to colour, religion, race, sexual orientation, as much as it does to gender. So the public must be clear there's no discrimination against women on the bench and no hurdles that can be dealt with being put in their way. And undoubtedly in domestic law, and particularly I would suppose family law and criminal law, it is important for female members of the public to feel that the judge fully understands their circumstances. But whether the boundary of a river runs along 43 degrees latitude or 44 degrees latitude, the sort of thing I deal with is not so readily linked to any gender-divided audience. But still, it's generally healthy, and it can only be a good thing that the UN is thoroughly engaged in trying to make all of this happen in the international courts as well. Well, I think I've said enough, and I now turn over to others.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Helena Kennedy, a barrister, writer, member of the House of Lords, and that's just a few of her many roles.
I'm going to stand up because I can't, otherwise I'm not going to be able to see a whole third of the audience, and I'm rather keen that when I speak that I do that. I also have to tell you, and it will happen to all of you when you come to practice in the courts, is that there is a thing about standing up. You feel that you can do it more effectively when you're on your feet. I want to start by immediately saying to our judge that of course she has made a difference when she asks the question whether she feels that she's made a difference. Because even having a clever, brilliant woman as she is in that kind of role is powerful in the message that it gives to the world about the capabilities of women. And that is an important and crucial message that comes from just doing it, Roz, and it's why we're so proud of you. As Roz has said, a huge shift has taken place. There she was, one of three women in a class at Cambridge when she was a student. Now in the law schools, we're talking about something of the order of 59% of law students being female. The shift that has taken place even in my time has been enormous. And I would imagine that even in the last 10 years, since someone like Shami studied law, again, the shift has been considerable. So we're seeing extraordinary changes taking place in the numbers of women coming into the law. Fabulous women. I see them as they apply to join sets of chambers like my own. Women who are choosing to go into human rights law, dedicated, committed women, and they are absolutely stunning. And they can knock the guys, I'm sorry to tell you fellas this, they can often knock the guys into a cocked hat. And so the question that we have to ask ourselves is, are those women going to make a difference? And I am absolutely sure that they will. What is interesting, though, is that there are a number of problems remaining which I think could pose problems, and someone like Kate Mallison, who's chairing tonight's event, has been doing very serious and important work in analysing how it is that that women become judges, what happens as disincentives in that process through the law towards appointments, what have been the hurdles for women. The many who, unlike Rawls, do experience discrimination, do come up against glass ceilings. What is it that happens to account for the small numbers of women getting to senior positions? Now, let me immediately say to you that part of the problem is, of course, something that expands out into the rest of our world. The whole business of the work-life balance is a problem for women in all professions. How do you do that business of having a career, having a very demanding professional life, if you want to have a life at all beyond it, if you want to have children, if you want to have a partner, whatever your sexuality, if you want to have a life outside of your profession, how can you manage all of that if you aren't going to give it some kind of 100% commitment? And I don't think that should be expected of anybody, male or female. What is it that happens? And there is no doubt that the point at which women make decisions to have children, there you see a great shift in the numbers of women who stay in the solicitor's profession or at the bar. We are having a look just now, we're monitoring what's taking place with a cohort who leave between the age of about 28 and 34. And there you see that, in fact, in that age group, men leave too, but in nothing like the numbers that women do. And so that some sudden exodus of women from practice, and it happens in solicitors' firms to some extent, but less so, but it happens there too. What is it that's happening? And what happens is that women have their first baby, that's difficult enough, but they can juggle it, but once they start moving into having two children, then the problems become so much the greater. And that business of balancing the two is very, very difficult. And still, and many women decide that they'd rather find another way of living their lives and perhaps being a lawyer in employment rather than in private practice. But there are other problems. And I have absolutely no doubt, and I've written about it a lot, but we still have the problem of who are the gatekeepers. Who are the people who are responsible for the promotion of people within the legal system? Who are the people who decide who gets to be a partner in the law firms in the city? Who are the people who decide when women should be promoted to silk or to a judicial appointment? And of course, we are fortunately in a stage of reforming all of this and creating a judicial appointments commission, which I hope will make a big difference to this. We have seen changes in recent years. We have seen a great rhetoric about encouraging a much greater diversity in the judicial appointment system. But we have seen for too long a sort of cloning of looking for people who replicate those who've gone before, people looking for judges who fit a mold of what it is imagined judges should be like. And that happens almost invisibly. It happens almost without people knowing that they're doing it. And if all the gatekeepers are men, and men of a particularly narrow caste, then the replication, the cloning of a particular type of person who ends up being in the senior judicial roles is something that I think we've recognised has been going on. There's a real issue here about who gatekeeps and what are the criteria for the appointment of judges. And while absolutely right that Roy should remind us that we certainly don't want to see anything but excellence being a deciding factor, the problem is who is it decides what is excellent, and is excellent looked for in particular forms? And I think that we have to really unpack the notion of merit. You know, that when they come to decide who's good enough, all the way through the system, when those judgments are made, are they made against a template which actually doesn't take account of some of the things that women can bring to the feast? And when women have actually had the experience of juggling their family lives with their professional lives, it often means that they're incredibly good managers. And in fact, sitting on certainly criminal courts, domestic courts, family courts, on those sort of courts, management actually is one of the skills that actually is required of a modern judge. And an awful lot of them don't have it. And women can often bring that because their actual professional experience mixed with their family life has meant they've had to be damn good at that business of management. But, of course, they don't describe it in that way. And what we need are a much clearer, a clearer sense of what it is that's required for someone to be a judge and to be a good judge, as well as intellectual prowess. One of the difficulties is that women don't ask. Women themselves do not, in this process of advancement, a great deal of talk about wanting women to come forward, women don't. The door may be unlocked, but women still stand outside knocking. And they don't actually themselves. They wait for someone to say, come on in. And that is a classic thing. I've experienced it all the way through my professional life, watching women who come to me who want those kind of appointments. It's never been part of my own career ambition. But women who wanted to become judges somehow wait for somebody to say they think that the time is right. And if you sit and wait, I'm afraid very often the invitation doesn't come. And women have to be very actively encouraged. I disagree with Roz, and I think that we probably come from a rather different standpoint on all of this. I am a criminal lawyer. I'm not an international lawyer. An international lawyer, I'm sure it's right, deals with a different kind of problem. And I would I imagine from Rosie's experience that Rosie is a true intellectual, and I would never describe myself as that at all. I am a lawyer, a frontline criminal lawyer. And the cases that I do in the courts are about representing people who come with usually a multitude of problems to the courtroom. And I happen to believe that a woman's perspective is important in that. The law has been made for too long by men and has been made from a male perspective. The gendered nature of criminal law is one of the things I have dealt with throughout my professional life, which is now has spanned 30 years. And that gendered nature of law is something that I can, I've written about it, I have experienced it in the courtroom, and I can tell you I still experience it in the courtroom. It hasn't changed despite our naming it, despite our knowing that it's there. The fact that certain kinds of behaviour is acceptable from men but isn't acceptable from women, the ways in which the law has been framed so that women are disadvantaged in trying to get themselves within those definitions, and we know all of that, those arguments around self-defence and so on. The way in which we've had to twist and turn with the provocation law in order to make it fit, now I want you all to know it's working rather well. Over the last, I would say, probably 5-7 years in acting for many, many women charged with killing their husbands after years of domestic violence, killing partners, I now feel that the provocation law is working very successfully, and I can't think of an occasion when I've had a murder conviction returned where there is a history of domestic violence and where I haven't been able to get the provocation law to work for women. But there are real issues remaining for women. And there are still double standards about how women are judged in our courts. The double sexual standard is something that I see repeatedly, and it's not just happening when we're dealing with sexual offences. It isn't just in rape cases. It goes across the board that if women are found and judged to be wanton and somehow not fulfilling society's expectations of what a decent woman should be doing, then I'm afraid it counts against her in the courtroom. We still have to explain the extraordinary numbers of women who are now being imprisoned, not violent women, the tripling of the numbers of women going to jail over the last 10 years. And the way in which I think you actually are seeing, in some ways, a sort of, it is another example, I think, of a sort of backlash that has taken place, where there is this notion now around that if you want to have equality, that equality means treating people exactly the same way, that you give equal treatment to people, when of course that is not what equality is about. Treating as equal those who are unequal only creates further inequalities, And that is what we're seeing happening to many women, where judges will say, well, I would be giving a fellow that 6 months, so why wouldn't I give it to a woman? When, of course, she may well be the caretaker, the primary carer of young children. The devastation to the family by incarcerating her is enormous, and so the punishment becomes double. And you see the same thing happening with the scandal there is in our prisons around women who are used as couriers, bringing drugs into the country, given monumental sentences, leaving behind families, often doing it because of poverty, and the sentence is worth twice as long because of what it means, that they're isolated in this country, separated from their families and children and so forth. So, I mean, I could talk to you for the evening about the whole business of how the law still is gendered and the way in which it deals with women and the way in which women are judged by different set of standards. I want to see more women in judicial roles because I do think having that perspective there will make a difference. I do not for one minute imagine that all women will come with a feminist perspective. No one would imagine that. Privileged women may often not know what it's like to live the lives of many of my clients and will not in any way bring any greater understanding than many men would have for the problems and background and context of these women's lives. But I do think that what we want is a diversity within our judiciary, a spread of people, and we want them to come from a variety of backgrounds, racial as well as in relation to gender. The myth of feminization. What are we talking about here? And is this one of the things that we're facing, is this notion that in order to get women into the judiciary that we're diluting the court, that the quality is going to sink. Let me assure you that in the general run of courts in this country, mediocrity amongst the judiciary is standard. And so the idea that women are going to be doing any worse than most of the guys that have been doing it in the circuit courts is ridiculous. So we should hit that on the head immediately. The other thing is this idea, and we're having it promulgated, particularly in the tabloid press, is that we're now seeing the feminization of particularly the family courts, so much so that women are have actually changed, if you like, the perspective in those courts. So now it's women who get the children automatically when it comes to the end of marriages and to custody issues. And that whole campaigning around families needing fathers and fathers for justice has been putting the spotlight on the family courts. Now, while it's true that there have been serious failures where injustices have taken place, again because of stereotyping of women as being the perfect persons to whom one would give the custody of children, which may not always be the case, but the reality is that in the majority of cases where access and custody rights for children are being denied, it's because there's a history of violence. And don't be mistaken about it. That is usually the background to it. But there is now a kind of new mythology being developed, which is that the courts are being feminized, that women are in the family division, of course, because that's where women have been clustered over the last 20, 30 years, that women were encouraged to go into those areas. And in those areas, we're now seeing men getting the rough end of the stick. Well, while there are areas of injustice there, I think that the distortion is the thing to hone in on. What we are seeing, really, is a sort of a backlash against some of the arguments that have been made about the way that women have been disadvantaged by law and by the courts. And we only have to look at the failure still to get justice in rape cases, to see that, in fact, the problems still exist. But we're seeing equivalence arguments mounted increasingly. The idea that, yes, there's domestic violence, but men are battered as much as women. Again, it isn't true. Yes, there are men who may be put in fear because of the behaviour of their womenfolk, but they are really very small numbers indeed. And so we keep having these calls being brought back up again of equivalence, the need for anonymity for men who may be charged with rape. If women are getting, who are alleging that they have been raped, are allowed anonymity, why shouldn't men? Without understanding the incredible reason why we've departed from the normal rule of openness of justice because of the failure of the courts to actually do justice for women and to provide any sense that, that women will be protected if they come forward and make their claim. Of course, you know, there's this increasing sense that, by repetition, that women lie, that women are still going to be bringing false charges against men. And those still live on, those mythologies, those stereotypes haven't yet been dealt with satisfactorily in the courts. So what I say to all of you is, if you're actually talking about the changes that have taken place, there are very important good changes in terms of finding what the problems are in the legal system, how we can draw more women into senior positions, how we can draw on that richness of talent of the women who are coming into the law in large numbers. But be clear that at the moment, for example, what is still close to women are some of the elite areas of the law, where it's still much harder for women to get into commercial chambers, still much harder for women to get into those areas where actually people make large sums of money. Women are actually, and often by choice, and it's been my choice in my life, are people who go into public service law, really. Women are far more the lawyers to be found practicing in the field of legal aid, and of course when we hear about the cuts in legal aid, it's actually women lawyers who are the people who are very often at the receiving end of that, and not the fat cat stereotyped male barrister who's supposed to be the beneficiary of all this plumped up legal aid. So there are still, I think, very real issues around all of this which we really need to continue to confront. It is not all over, this issue of whether the battles have been won. I'm afraid that there are still problems for women. Happily, the profession is much, much more accommodating, and the ways in which chambers select people and so on have now become so much better that actually I think that in the business of getting into chambers and getting pupillages, the disadvantages that were there have almost completely gone. They still exist in some areas, but for the most part, those are going. The difficulties now are at a later stage, where women are in their 30s, and it's about the life balance of how we can get that to work better. And the next thing is, how do we get women onto the bench in real numbers? And I think it makes a difference. It's where I depart from Roz's view. I think it does make a difference. And it makes a difference because women in the general public deserve to see that justice is actually not a male enterprise. So we need more women in there, and we need to be determined to make sure that the law delivers for women.
Thanks. Our third speaker is Nicola Lacey, Professor of Criminal Law here at the LSE.
Thank you, Kate. Well, it's a huge pleasure to be here in front of such a wonderfully large audience and with such distinguished co-panelists and chair. So I'll just start by sort of locating myself in the processes we've been talking about. As many of you know, because I have the pleasure to teach some of you, I've spent my professional life working partly teaching future generations of lawyers, practicing and academic, and partly writing about law and legal policy. And I'm going to divide my comments into those two headings, really, rather loosely observing the rubric that we've been given, but very much bearing that in mind. Now, you have to start by knowing about me that although I like to think that my legal education wasn't that long ago. I managed to complete the whole of it without ever being taught by a woman. Indeed, I was, the same can be true of race, ethnicity. I was only ever had one teacher who wasn't a white man. So I could hardly sit here and say to you that I think that role models are a precondition for women getting on with their careers. But I have to say to you that I differ from Roz somewhat in the sense that I do think that role models are very important. And I'm very proud insofar as I can be one because I know how much they meant to me at a later stage in my career. In fact, I'll just share with you a little anecdote. I spent 3 years of my career in the middle of the 1980s as the only woman fellow of a college in Oxford. And I can still remember the sort of visceral feeling of delight when the next woman arrived. I can still remember what she was wearing, bright green tights and matching earrings, and it just made me so cheerful. And it gave me an added sense of belonging, and I'm very sort of sensitive to that. On the other hand, I have to say with Roz that I personally don't feel I've ever experienced any discrimination. Although, like Roz, I know many women who have, and I'd again like to share with you a very, very nice line from a woman who was briefly a colleague of mine in Stanford years ago, a woman called Barbara Babcock, very much loved and respected academic and practicing lawyer in the States, who spent some part of her career as the Deputy Attorney General in President Jimmy Carter's government. And when she was asked for the umpteenth time, "Aren't you worried that you were only given this job because you're a woman?" she said, and I'm just so sorry that I'm not a good mimic because Barbara Babcock has the most wonderful Arkansas accent, but she said in her very languorous voice, she said, "Well, I've had the other experience many times and I prefer this one." You have to learn lines like that to deal with these annoying questions. I always used to say when I was asked the same question about my job in Oxford, I always used to say, "Well, if they elected me because I'm a woman, at least they won't be disappointed." But looking at the changes, I mean, to have got through a rather long legal education 20 years ago without ever being taught by a woman, it does look amazing now, because most law departments, most good law departments like the LSE Law Department, have many, many women teachers, including women in senior positions. And I certainly feel that that's a very solid thing in my workplace and something I really appreciate. I would say, though, and to utter it sounds like a gross generalisation, but I firmly believe it to be true, that many women in the workplace, including the academic workplace, still tend to carry a kind of double burden as a result of being female. And that has to do with a certain kind of often invisible, but in my view hugely important, emotional housework in the workplace. Just being around to talk to people, to listen in a very informal and unstructured way. Something I personally enjoy doing, but it's not something you're ever going to get much career advancement by doing, let me tell you. So, in a way, the teaching side of the academy is a success story in terms of the questions for this debate. Of course, one could cynically ask whether the relatively depressed nature of academic salaries has had something to do with this feminization. But without passing over that, I think one has to say, and this really brings me on to the profession, the practice profession, that one of the things that I think has brought and kept many women into academic life is its flexibility. And this sort of brings me to one of the points that Helena was touching on. I have, of course, many former students and friends and indeed former colleagues who work in the legal profession. And this question of the work-life balance is the primary question that they debate and puzzle about. And I still feel very sure, though my evidence is only anecdotal, that there is a major problem in the legal profession, both sides of it, about being written off if not only you have children, but if you make it very clear that you intend to spend some time parenting them. And what I'm told and find very plausible is that the difficulty is not just a difficulty from the top, it's a difficulty of competition in the sense that many young men are prepared to work what really are quite crazy hours. And this really brings me to a point that Roz made, which I thoroughly agree with, which is that unfortunately I don't think any of this is going to change decisively until the domestic division of labour changes. And here we still struggle with a kind of public-private distinction in terms of what are the really key issues here. I think unless we have a fairer sharing, not just of work burdens, but also of the sense of responsibility for organising the division of labour in the household, because of course many women in the legal profession are very privileged women who can afford to buy services, but nonetheless you bet your bottom dollar that it's mostly they who are organising it. So that's still a major issue. But here's another argument which hasn't been mentioned yet, which I've had put to me by senior lawyers, particularly in some of the large corporate law firms. And it's this, it's that a combination of new technologies which make it possible for things to move very fast, and the globalization to some extent of markets and the legal practice that follows those markets, has made speed the essence of the operation. That, you know, law firms now work and operate a 24-hour service, and that people who aren't prepared to work in that kind of way are going to be disadvantaged, and this is very difficult with parenting and so on. I find this argument frankly puzzling, because I've never met anyone, even a man, who pretends that they can work for 24 hours, let alone several days running. And it seems to me that this structure ought to be, in a sense, favouring a more flexible approach to work, in the sense that it must surely be premised on teamwork. So I'm a little bit cynical about the motivations behind the apparently economically extraordinarily irrational apparent willingness of many firms to let women drain away in their late 20s and early 30s, having spent a lot of time training them up, seems completely economically irrational. I suspect that it's a bit like the truth of the old civil service, that it actually has a managerial advantage, that in an intensely hierarchical and competitive profession, it actually makes management easier when some group of the workforce disappear. And unfortunately, the pro-equality norm is not strong enough yet to challenge that particular convenience. Let me come now to the question of legitimacy. I do think here, I'm a little bit more optimistic than Helena. I think that there has been, in the last decade or so, a sort of key change in terms of how far, if not the tabloids, the sort of so-called quality press and radio and television, does regard diversity in the legal profession on the bench as a sort of index of legitimacy. I agree that there's a backlash, and unfortunately it's not only in the tabloids, and it's a very ill-informed, although rhetorically powerful, backlash. Nonetheless, I think that, for example, the more balanced, which was the majority response to Brenda Hale's appointment in the to the Judicial Committee of the House of Lords, was something that was a hopeful sign. So let me move to the law itself. It's a mixed picture. I see some cause for optimism in developments like the new sexual offences legislation. I'm not a fan of all of it, but I think that particularly the white paper that preceded it acknowledged in a way that one couldn't really have imagined in the same way even a decade ago, the idea that law reform should be shaped by an understanding of the experiences of those who are the object of legal regulation. And I think that's hugely to the credit of many people like Helena, who have written, campaigned, pressure groups, Liberty, all these sorts of movements, and the women's movement have helped produce that sort of result. Although I entirely take Helena's point when she says, as she pointed out to me in discussion just before we came in here this evening, that the difficulty is that it's a particular vision of what the woman's experience of a sex offence is, and the difficulty remains, as you were mentioning, Helena, that if you don't fit that model, you may not benefit from this newly, as it were, victim-sensitive approach. More locally, though, I think I find hope in not simply, although it's a wonderful example, a judgment of Brenda Hale when she was in the Court of Appeal, a minority judgment, I'm sorry to say, but one in which she assessed the claim of a couple who had become pregnant, the woman had become pregnant due to, it was alleged, medical negligence, in terms of a sort of some frank speaking about the nature of pregnancy and parenting. I thought that was very hopeful. And I found it very hopeful when a male member of the House of Lords talked specifically about the impact on women of a broadcast, which various broadcasters had refused to air as a party political or party election broadcast, which involved some very distressing images of abortions of fetuses, and quite a lot of emphasis was given in this, in Lord Hoffman's speech in the House of Lords, to the specific impact on women, on the fact that women would be, as it were, the majority group affected by the, whatever decision was made. So I see some causes for hope, but hell, I'm an academic, I can't resist analysing. So I'm going to conclude just with a couple of thoughts about why it is that perhaps we haven't made more progress than we have, and really taking off from the point that Helena was making about the limits of formal equality. We've always known that formal equality was limited, and that treating people unequally situated equally in a formal sense is a recipe for further inequality and injustice. Now, of course, we've had formal equality in this country on sex lines since 1975 formally, and on basis of race, ethnicity, nationality, in theory even more incompletely since 1976. But I want to point out another couple of problems about this era in which, in a sense, the battle for formal equality, let's assume, has been won, and in which we're in this terrain of trying to make a clear case, because that's what we have to do politically with a small p, for a substantive equality, treating as equals, not formally equal, approach. Now, I think there are two issues that occur to me. The first is that formal inequality, rank prejudice, is visible. It's easy to identify. It's easy to campaign against. The minute you get to the point of, for example, to use the legal framework, indirect discrimination, the differential effects of policies or rules which are facially neutral, you're on much more subtle terrain. You have to make a more nuanced argument. You have to produce a lot of data. And here is the second problem, that the minute you start thinking about those effects, and if you're a fair-minded person, you of course see, as we all know in the women's movement, that women are not one group, and that other differences of ethnicity, religion, race, class, poverty, life experience intersect with the social vector of gender. Now, speaking as an amateur social scientist, I'm perfectly convinced that gender remains a hugely important social vector of differentiation, both in terms of how we think about ourselves and relate to others, and in terms of how we're treated by social, political, legal institutions. But we've acknowledged that this is not the only difference, that it intersects with other differences, and this makes the arguments that we have to put more complicated, more subtle, and that, I'm afraid, in a soundbite era, makes them harder to get across. So those are just a couple of sort of analytic thoughts about why perhaps the political challenge that we face now is harder in a way than that was faced in, say, the 1960s. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'll hand over to our last speaker, Shami Chakrabarti, who's the director of Liberty. You're quite right to leave now. Well, goodness me, I have the daunting task of attempting to follow that, but I will begin by saying, like everyone else, I'm absolutely delighted to be back here at the LSE, where I spent an incredibly happy and important 3 years as an undergraduate, and where Liberty, the concept and the organisation, has so many dear and important friends. Now, you can imagine how daunted I am following the speakers that I've heard, not least because this isn't my usual brief or subject, this feminism and the law stuff. But I still don't flinch from it, and I'm actually delighted to be here and glad to have spoken last in a sense, because I want to respond partly to some of the things that have been said. I suppose that partly my place on this platform
is, if people will forgive me saying so, to be the token teenager in this context. Like being 35,
don't
I think.
Knock it.
Being 35, I suppose in legal professional terms, I can almost pass. And please don't take offence, you know, distinguished panelists as to that. I was called to the bar about 10 years ago. Did pupillage and a little bit of time after that. Found the experience interesting but strange and very male. I'll be honest about that. But I am a complex human being, as we all are. I am not just a woman. I am also black and short, and a lawyer, and went to a comprehensive school. And I don't say that because I have a series of chips on my shoulder, because I think that if one is chippy about any of those things, one does a terrible disservice to the people whose cause you're trying to promote, or to oneself, actually. But equally, to flinch from aspects that are absolutely essential to my humanity and my individuality, like my race and my gender and my class or social experience, is also to do, I think, a disservice to all of those people with whom I connect and to myself. And that is very much the way in which I enter this discussion. I do think that the generational issue is interesting and important here. If I may say so, when I heard Roslyn's comments, they reminded me very much of experiences and comments that were shared with me when I had the privilege of being a government lawyer for 6 years. And I have to say that that was an interesting environment where I personally flourished far more as a lawyer than I did at the bar. And I don't think it's completely accidental that that was a more diverse environment, certainly in terms of gender, and indeed a very different environment in terms of a more, I would say, collegiate atmosphere, a more conventional place of employment, a place where understatement and being helpful to a colleague are considered to be very important means of success, rather than the conventional bar model. I don't think that any of that is accidental, and it was in that environment that I probably flourished most in my career, both in terms of promotion and in terms of just personal development. And to go back to Roslyn's comments, I don't feel that I've ever experienced discrimination. And of course, what can one say about that? Say that if you are as brilliant as Rosalind, you are going to be less aware of discrimination, frankly, whether in truth you ever have experienced it or not. And you know, if you're really going to look at discrimination, you do have to look at the experiences, perhaps, of the more of the rest of us who are a little bit more, who are mediocre minds. I would suggest you should forgive me saying that. But I had the privilege in the Home Office to work with some of the finest legal and policy minds that I have met in my career, and I include senior judges and silks and others in that group. There are some very senior women in the civil service, and there is a critical mass of them. So it is a different environment, but many of a different generation to mine. When you did have those conversations, those admiring, you know, conversations, those questioning conversations about what it had been like in the 60s or the 70s. There was a slight embarrassment. I remember someone who remains a very dear friend of mine, a very senior government lawyer, saying, "Oh, Shami, I wish people wouldn't keep talking about that sort of stuff. It really wasn't like that. It really isn't like that." And I'm sure that is perhaps the perception. But I think that, just as, you know, I don't run around being chippy and saying that, you know, every job that I've never got or every argument that I've lost has been to do with being a woman, that's clearly not the case. I think that one has to be a little more realistic as well. I never felt positively hampered. I never felt that I didn't get a promotion or I didn't get a job or I didn't win an argument or whatever for being a woman. But I will show, I'm trying to be about as honest as I dare, which is pretty honest, actually. I do remember it once being related to me by a third party that a senior male colleague had said of me, Shami is of great statistical benefit to this department. And, you know, and of course that cut me to the quick, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't said in refusing me a job or a promotion. It was just said, and goodness me, and I'm not saying that means I've been discriminated against, I'm not running around being cross, I've had a very privileged and lucky life and career to date, but I think in the light of that it would be slightly naive of me to suggest that I don't think that discrimination is out there, even in an institution such as the Senior Civil Service, which I actually think has made some very positive steps as compared with, say, the bar or private practice. So I sort of make that sort of personal observation. Of course, at various stages in my career, and it still happens occasionally, people will ask me if I'm at all worried. And again, this relates back to some of the points that Rosalind made. Whether I'm at all worried, have I ever been worried that I might have conversely got a job because of my statistical benefit, of which, and there are various benefits in that respect, not just the gender one. And I think that maybe, you know, originally I might have been troubled by that, but you know what, I'm not troubled by that at all. And when people say that to me, I tend to. This is. I told you the self-deprecation would end, didn't I? I tend to reply, not so much a token as a beacon.
Very good.
And well, slightly silly, but that is essentially how I feel about it. I may not feel that I have the brilliant mind of Rosalind Higgins or even other people around this table, but I am perfectly, I'm a perfectly competent, committed lawyer, and always have been. And well, thank you so much. I'm so much more than a competent and committed lawyer. And you know, one should not be afraid of that or ashamed of that. And equally, my experience of the Government Legal Service and of the Civil Service is that actually senior women do more than just this rather passive thing of being role models. I think that. Maybe this is where I differ with some of the other panellists. In addition to being a lawyer or being a clever lawyer, I have been involved in an employed context, which I think is important. I have been managed, often quite badly, by men and women, and it is now part of my role to manage and mentor younger lawyers, and I take that terribly seriously, and I do think that that is an important aspect of this. So it's not simply the passive role model input, which I agree is incredibly important. And you know, as an undergraduate, I can remember you know, being at the back of some of Rosalind's public international law lectures, and I can remember many times listening to Helena speak and being quite inspired to come to what otherwise I frankly thought of as a pretty crusty old distant profession called the bar. So I think it is partly the role model thing, but it's also partly something much more active, which is hands-on, which is inspiring and mentoring and managing. And of course, lawyers generally, this isn't a simple gender point, lawyers generally, in my experience, are terrible managers of people, managers of expectations, managers of their clients, managers of each other, because it is not something that's taken very seriously in legal training or legal culture. And actually, it's these incredibly important skills. And so I think that it's not a simple gender point there. It's a more complex point about the range of skills that are relevant and important in various aspects of the legal profession. Going back to my fellow panelists, I do think that it's interesting that if you look at the range of experience, there is nobody here from, I think, the commercial bar or from the city, perhaps I'm wrong there, but I do think that if you are going to look at all seriously at how well equality is working, gender equality is working in the legal profession, you really do have to sit back and have a long, hard look at the commercial bar and at city law firms, which, for whatever reason, they are considered by many people, and certainly in reward, financial reward terms, are the elite of the profession. And I really do think that the situation there is really very alarming and still pretty staggering, as Nicola suggested. I mean, there are many very able trainee solicitors, women, young women solicitors, many of whom I studied with going into city law firms, but how many of them are going up that pyramid and actually making equity partner as opposed to even junior partner? And I was talking to a senior partner in a city law firm just at the weekend who was vaguely contemplating going for head of litigation in her firm, and the sorts of umming and ahhing and the politics of the election process of what in such a male-dominated environment was really interesting, and would, I think, confound some of the things that are being said here about, you know, I've never experienced discrimination, whatever. I think in these places it is very, very real, and there's no question that it must be contributed to by this whole problem about the ridiculous way in which work is organised in city law firms and, I think, at the commercial bar, this ridiculous machismo about... And I think some of it is a myth, actually. This machismo that they work so much harder. You know, they work 24 hours a day. What about, you know, legal aid defence solicitors getting called out to the police station at 3 o'clock in the morning? And I really do think that some of that is hyped, and I also agree that technology is neutral, is morally neutral. It can make our lives easier or harder. It can interfere with our privacy or not, and we can build in. We can use it as an excuse, but we can also use it as a promoter of the moral values that we choose to imbibe it with. Is the question of women in the law at all relevant? Well, as you will guess, I think it is relevant, and I think it's relevant in two ways. I do think that it's incredibly relevant to legitimacy, and that is particularly true, I think, in my own area of human rights law, where legitimacy of the law and of lawyers, and in particular of judges, is not what it should be and not what it must be if human rights law is going to be a bulwark against this terrible authoritarian trend and this disrespect for the rule of law. I think the legitimacy of lawyers, of law and of judges really needs to be bolstered. And I also think that my experience of the law, which is essentially as a policy lawyer in the Home Office, working predominantly in areas like crime and asylum, and, you know, and as a litigator and now at Liberty, I do think that it is relevant to the way in which certain legal arguments are framed and the way in which certain decisions are made or at least presented. And of course, as lawyers, we've got to think that the law is viewed by a world out there beyond the precise deconstruction of legal judgments and whether, you know, whether they stand up to scrutiny. Mm-hmm. Will they actually stand up to the human arguments and concerns of people in the wider world. On legitimacy, I agree perhaps with Rosalind. I don't know. I'm not a scientist about not necessarily having a feminine mind, but goodness me, I have a human experience which is partly coloured by being a woman and partly coloured by being a mother, for that matter. And so I don't think it's about some sort of weird eugenic argument about whether you have a black mind or a female mind, but I do think that human experience colours the way in which you frame legal arguments and can colour certain judgments. And there's no question that if the judiciary is going to be a satisfactory bulwark against these arguments about democratic deficit and so on, particularly in the most political areas where fundamental human rights need to be protected, and there is an end in itself in the judges just appearing to be more like the rest of society. And this isn't just about women whose cases are being adjudicated looking up to a bench that has some women in it. It's about all people seeing their richness and diversity, black, white, working class, middle class, etc., reflected in the judiciary. And why? Because we don't want to elect the judges. They can, by definition, not be democratic legitimacy for an independent judiciary that is supposed to safeguard, for example, fundamental human rights. So there must be some kind of demographic legitimacy. That I think is very important, particularly in the most politicised areas, asylum policy, counter-terror policy, etc., etc. It is going to be so much harder for populist politicians, popular tabloid press, to rubbish these old white men in wigs for just sticking up for fundamental human rights. And that benefits everyone, not just women. That is the big, important constitutional point about legitimacy, which is why I think the government, who I don't often have the pleasure of applauding, but it's a nice pleasure when it does come, are right to try and look at the diversity of the judiciary, even if it does upset the judiciary. Upsetting the judiciary has never been a particular problem for this or recent governments. I also think, in relation to this whole diversity of the judiciary argument, I am bolstered in my conviction by the counter-arguments. You know, it's like Europe. If you're not quite sure how you feel about Europe, you get swayed by the fact that, you know, Robert Kilroy Silk and his friends are against it. And you kind of think, well, I better be for it, you know. And I have to, again, share with you a little personal anecdote about chatting about suggestions that the judiciary needed to be made more diverse. Chatting with someone who was on vaguely friendly terms, quite friendly terms, a public law silk. And we were talking about whether the judiciary really ought to be more representative to be legitimate. And his response was, well, if the judiciary was going to be representative, we would have people who lacked mental capacity sitting on the bench.
Maybe we do.
And she gets the applause even for my joke. So you can imagine the temptations in my reply, and I had to take several deep breaths before I suggested to this gentleman that might not be the best way to put his argument to various people if meritocracy was what he was interested in. And finally, on the actual content of the law, as opposed to just these issues of appearance and legitimacy, vital though I think they are, I do think that there are moments when the actual experience, not the brain, not the left brain or the right brain, I don't understand that stuff, but the actual experience, the gender experience, or the more complex experience of being the fully rounded human being that you are very relevant, in particular in some very politicised areas of policy. As a policy lawyer in the Home Office, I was vaguely involved in a piece of legislation which was concerned with limiting the type of questions that women rape complainants should be asked in rape trials. There had been some horrific cases of women effectively being subjected to rape twice, once in real terms and a second time, you know, 10 days questioning in the Old Bailey by the defendant and so on. Some absolutely ghastly stories that had actually led to the United Kingdom being found in violation of Article 3 of the Convention on Human Rights in the Strasbourg Court. So bad and so unregulated was this questioning by the defendant in person, yeah, that the UK was being found in violation of these women's fundamental human rights. And of course, the instinctive answer to that as a lawyer, because I'm a lawyer as well as a woman, as well as a black woman, as well as a whatever, director of liberty, the instinctive answer to questions of that, like that, must be, well, judges should be better trained, judges should be able to control that situation, they should restrain the person has a right to represent himself, but he should be managed. That's what a judge is there for. That is the instinctive and perfectly understandable lawyer's answer. But of course, the judges had the opportunity to do that for years and years and years, and they had not taken that opportunity, which would be, in public policy terms, the best solution. Now, the solution that was arrived at in this piece of legislation that I worked on as a government lawyer was incredibly controversial, and to some extent, rightly controversial, because it severely limited the ability of a defendant to cross-examine his accuser. It was his accuser. some very serious issues about the presumption of innocence and the right to a fair trial and hampering the questions in this murky and very controversial territory of rape trials. Let's not run away from that. Not just murky in terms of gender politics, but just murky in terms of the lack of consensus that we have in society as a whole about what the rule, what the highway code is in relation to sexual conduct. And so there was basically a legislative straitjacket that was constructed in the Youth Justice and Criminal Evidence Act of 1999 to severely curtail the ability of the defendant to ask questions about the sexual history of the accuser. Now, this, you will have heard about this issue, and this case was one of the big early blockbuster cases under the Human Rights Act, case called the Crown against Bay, and it went all the way to the House of Lords, who did find, quite possibly rightly so in my view, that the straitjacket was too tight, and by using the Human Rights Act and the interpretative obligations in that act, they performed an amazing feat, I think, which is they found a way to reread this legislation. Whether I think that was the right thing to do is for another day. But the point is, that is no way to deal with the complexity of a criminal courtroom. And the far better approach to dealing with matters of that kind is not a legislative straitjacket that is capable of doing great injustice.
It was compensating for judicial failure.
Indeed. The way to approach problems of that kind is definitely to have a broader and more diverse and more street-smart bench that can cope with issues of that kind, both in terms of legitimacy, but also in terms of sheer human, and sometimes that means feminine, experience. So that's my final anecdote on the actual content of the law, as well as my sort of rambling anecdotes. And now I'll shut up.
Many thanks. We've got about 5-7 minutes left. Oh, sorry. So what we'll do is we've got time to take a few questions. What I suggest is that we perhaps take two or three and then answer them together. Would that make sense? So there was one over there. There's a mic coming round. Just
thank you very much, Jamie. Can I just address a couple of comments to you, if I may? I was one of those lawyers in a city firm in the 70s, and I can tell you that there's been a complete sea change compared with how it was then. In my firm, there had never been a woman lawyer employed. I know, it's extraordinary. And the second comment I wanted to make was that I think there's an amazing impact on English lawyers and English practices of globalization, and America in particular.
Somebody back there in the pink.
Hi, I would like to address this question to the judge, Rosalind Higgins. And would you please tell me all the steps you have taken to become a judge? For example, after graduation of LLB degree, did you continue to pursue a high degree or a higher academic degree, or you just practice as a lawyer first? And how did you deal with the problem of career break? Thank you.
Thank you.
How did you
deal with probably career break?
Hi, I was particularly interested in Professor Lacey's comments about work and the family. I'm just beginning my training now, so I don't have that much experience of it, but what I do is related to, my main experience has been about the divide between women rather than women against. For example, people like India Knight write about it quite a lot at the moment, and it is something that I find again and again when I talk to women who want to train as lawyers, that there's a lot of competition between women, between the approach that you should have. And I was wondering if the panel thinks that is a factor, and if it is, how do we change it? Because I've had people say to me, when I say that I definitely want to have children and I want to take time out to do that, people say to me, why are you even bothering? And that's women who are of my generation doing the same thing as me. Why are you even wasting your time doing a career? And do you think this is a factor? And if so, how do we change it?
Should we just have one last question over at the back?
I actually have a couple of quick questions. First one for actually any of you who want to comment. First is, do you all believe in quotas? And if so, why? And if not, why not? And if you do, what do you do if there's not enough women to fulfill those quotas? Second one quickly is, Judge Higgins thankfully talked earlier about the need for better choices and better support for women with their partners. However, a lot of people say that the choice of women to leave because they want to take care of their children is biological and has nothing to do with the choice of partner. And I just wanted to know if any of you agree with that.
Okay.
I can't see, so I'm going to have to stand up so that I can see people on that side of the hall. First of all, yes, I gave a lecture down at Clifford Chance last week, and I was happy to see that in the audience there were much greater numbers of women than I actually had expected to see there. Yes, there are many of those women coming through. It's like the rest of the law. At the highest levels, there are very few senior partners still in many of the big law firms. But I think that there are issues around what will happen when those women want to balance their lives with having a family. So it comes back down to this issue, which is here and will recur for all of us. Because lots of young women are very, and feel there's no problems at all until they hit that moment of having their children. When I had children, it was quite interesting that even at that point, there was a division of certain of what I used to call macho mothering, where there were women who would say, I had my baby and I was back in court 5 days later. and I can tell you, I was certainly not going to be back in court 5 days later. And nor did I want to. And actually, what happened for me, and I look back on it and I give it as a reassurance to other women, I was absolutely panicked that everybody would forget me if I took a lot of time out. And so in fact, I didn't tell anybody I was pregnant until I was 7 months pregnant. I went around with loose looking things and if you're wearing a gown and a coat, then nobody notices. I was all intentional so that I didn't, I was only pregnant then for 2 months. And then I took, with my first child, I took 4 months off. And actually, with each subsequent baby, I took more time off. Because I realized that people didn't forget you, actually. And that in the scheme of things, the period of time that you take out is actually quite small. And if you're doing kind of quite serious cases, it can be one case. If you're doing a big case, then very often the kind of time that you're taking out, 6 months or something, is no longer than you're not being available for solicitors because you're busy at work. So we are kind of panicked about that because of being self-employed. And I now say to them, calm. It's not like that. Nobody's going to forget you, And I do think that there is a lack of sympathy often from women who've done it in a different way. My generation, when I came to the bar and was practicing, I came from a working class background. The bar was highly privileged. The women who had sort of gone before, on the whole, had been women from more privileged backgrounds. And many of them found that the way to deal with having children was really that they went off to boarding school when the children were very young and so on. Well, for any of us who didn't want to do that, we were presenting a different way of being a mother. We wanted to actually have our kids around us. We wanted to spend time with them. We wanted to be able to go home in the evening. We didn't want to be in the wine bar chatting up solicitors. And that's the problem, is about all those things that are expected of you. That whole business of the culture being very still not conducive to the business of having a family and working life. And some women are very unsympathetic to it. I still hear senior women at the bar saying, if a woman can't deal with sexual harassment, then she isn't tough enough to be at the bar. And the idea is that you're supposed to just wallop somebody that happens to do it. And a big change has happened on all of this. Because when I started at the bar in the early 70s, you kind of got groped and you accepted it. You just avoided the person who did it to you, but you didn't make any kind of issue out of it. I remember saying this at a dinner recently, and a guy in the audience shouted out, "Those were the days!" And I'll see you later. But it has changed, and women shouldn't have to accept that kind of thing. And we, as women at the bar, should be encouraging and supportive of other women and make clear what the new rules of the game are. And I regret it when I hear women be unsupportive to others. Of course women should be able to take time out. Of course women should be able to say, "I want to actually go out for a couple of years." We in our chambers now have made it very clear that there's no question of this business of paying rent when you're not there. We actually do it on the basis of a percentage into chambers anyway, so there isn't a kind of rent. But we're still facing at the bar some chambers who charge a rent and expect women to pay even when they're not there or even when they take time out for maternity leave or to have spend time with their work children when they're very young. Unacceptable. Has to all stop. Is it a biological thing that women might want to do with their children? I think that many women do yearn to have more time with small children. And I don't think that you can have a template for how it has to be done. I don't think it should be like that. Women should be able to make their own choices in their own way. And indeed, the same should be true for men in the law as well. And we should be devising better plans. And I think that what we're all agreeing on this panel is that issue of work-life balance is still a real issue. And it's particularly an issue at the bar. Because, yes, when you're in a law firm, you could do job shares. You could do flexible working and so on. If you're doing a criminal trial, you have to be there every day that the trial's going on. And there's no way that you can actually sort of do a three-day week. It just isn't going to work like that. And so what it is that for people like myself, having had children, I made sure that I didn't do cases back to back. I took more time out in between them, tried to make space for my family life because it mattered to me. And I think that we can do that, but we as colleagues should help each other to make that possible. And so, I mean, those are the things that I wanted to say. I think that there has been a big impact, and I want to just mention this before I sit down, which is that the court in Canada, two of the women on the Supreme Court in Canada are very close friends of mine. And Beverly McLaughlin and Claire Lefebvre-Dubé, whom I've known for over 10 years, would say to you, actually, it did make a difference. They've now got five women on the Supreme Court, five out of nine. Is it five out of nine? Yeah. I mean, they would say to you, because of their being there, it changed the discourse. It changed the nature of the discourse. And so, in fact, the men are just as much protectors of women's rights. But it's because the whole process was changed by having women in there in a critical mass. And that is why it matters, is because it does change the way people think and talk about things. It changes the discourse. And that's what we have to, why we have to keep this show on the road.
Shall we? Just briefly, to the woman at the back who was the first solicitor taken on in her city law firm in the 1970s, goodness me, you must be a very brilliant lawyer. And is all I can say to that, if you achieved that in the 70s. I'd sweep up everything else into one comment, which is very personal. My husband is the same age as me, so we're both sort of 35-year-old lawyers, and he's a partner in a city law firm. He's just moved there from the public sector. I, of course, work in the impoverished NGO sector. But what I will say about him is, not only does he bring home the bacon, he then proceeds to cook it as well. And that's true. And I know that you will not believe this, and all this will make you sick, and you'll think that I'm bragging. But I really can say, and I don't know quite how this happened, but that we really are equal partners and take it in turns to collect our 2-year-old from the nursery, even though I'm supposedly in the flexible voluntary sector and he's a partner in a city law firm with commercial clients. So I think that Rosalind is quite right that makes a huge, huge difference, and I couldn't dream of taking on a job like the one I've taken.
It's not about luck, it's about judgment.
Well, yes, very sensible. No, I mean, actually, if you're going to be frank about it,
choose well.
Yeah, and choose well, and I did, But And so in relation to these comments about women helping other women and biology and all the rest of it, just to sweep it up, I do think that it's not just old-fashioned gender war anymore, because I do think it's about getting in touch, not with our just our gender, but with our humanity. And I have friends who are like my husband, who are also men. And my husband was devastated when he had to go back to work after 2 weeks after our son was born, and incredibly jealous of the fact that I took 6 months. And I'm told that... By friends at the bar, because apparently the bar is reforming in places, and I take their word for it. But in the more enlightened sets of chambers, and actually the bar ought to be so much better a model, because these people are rich and self-employed and blah blah blah. They ought to be able to organise things, but it's been such a myth in previous years. I am told that in the places where there is now a greater critical mass of women, life is better for the men as well. And they start to enjoy their lives. And so it isn't just about the gender, it is about the broader humanity. And, you know, women that have worked with and for my husband say that he has been, you know, very good as a manager and very very good as a mentor. So I'm very proud of that too. And I do think that it isn't just about alliances with women, though I have to say they've been incredibly important to me in my career. It is also about connecting with this unspoken human urge to have a bit of a life and care a bit about your family too. And that is really, I think, ultimately at this stage in the story, the next step forward.
Well, I was asked a specific question at the back there. I can't imagine my answer is of any interest except to the person who asked it, but as she did, I will. I was one of those who went into academic life first after degrees at Cambridge and Yale, and then found myself doing advisory work. And interestingly, it was my husband who said, "Why don't you get called?" And then you don't have to turn away from all this advisory stuff at the court door. And I was the one who thought, no, you can't do it all. But he pushed me into that direction, for which obviously I owe a great debt in the way that everything has gone since. Now, when I did get called, in fact, I was in one of the leading commercial sets. And so I was doing the international law stuff in the big commercial cases. So I was one of those women who was in this commercial law environment from the beginning. And again, I personally always found it welcoming, which is not to say that I for one moment don't believe, you know, all the less fortunate stories that have happened to others. And then I was asked this question, well, what about the problem of your career break? And this is where my fellow panelists have now made me feel extremely inadequate, because I've heard about the delights of the six-month break and the expression of macho mothering. This is where I have to confess that I took 6 weeks out and didn't want any more. not because, you know, I felt the need to go and chat up the solicitors because they might be forgetting me, because I thought I'd throttle the little darlings if I stayed near them for much longer. So it all goes to show, as Helena says, there's no template, and what is important, we have the choice. And I'm incredibly close to my kids, and I've just been to mother care with my daughter this afternoon, who's just had her baby. And, you know, there are many ways of skinning the cat, and the important thing is to find what's right for you and to make those decisions with your family and to do your best at getting the balance in these things right.
I'll be very brief because it's getting late, but we were asked as a panel one question which I think we've collectively ducked, or which my co-panelists have kindly left to me, which is the the important and very difficult question of quotas, on which we could certainly spend a whole evening. My personal view is that I'm not for rigid quotas, in part for pragmatic reasons, because I think they lack legitimacy and I think they're counterproductive. I am in favour, although as a context-dependent thing, of targets, which I think help to concentrate the mind in terms of policy at various levels. But that, I mean, that's a very general answer. I'd just finally like to come back to the point which Helena's already answered beautifully, but the point that you made about other women. And just to say, you know, in a sense, it's only to be expected that one option for women is to, you know, it's there in George Bernard Shaw, make themselves more like a man. And it's not surprising that that's happening. But let's not take our eye off the gatekeepers, whom Helena talked about at the beginning, and let's try not to hold each other to a higher standard than we hold our male colleagues to. It can be a little bit tough. So, of course, we all know that we do expect more of women. But that can be a problem in the workplace as well. So...
Well, we've run over, and I'm absolutely sure that we could probably sit here for another couple of hours talking about this and still have only scratched the surface. And I just want to thank you all for coming and to ask you just finally to join me in thanking our speakers for their fabulous, fabulous talk.